Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin, joined again today by Josh Blank, research director from the same Texas Politics Project. Good late morning, Josh.
Good late morning to you. Ready to open myself to the universe and,
yes.
And talk about
it. We had Josh doing a little yoga before we started.
Well, you said you're ready to open yourself to the universe. I'm a little afraid what the universe is going to
That's
going to put back.
That's the trick of opening yourself to the universe. The universe is a...
I don't want to extend the metaphor too far, but it makes me nervous.
A little more yang than yen sometimes. I don't know. Lately, it seems like. So obviously, once again, a lot going on.
Yeah.
Many stories in the news. The shutdown of the federal government looms pretty large at this moment, but, we should flag a couple of things going on, somewhat adjacent to our world. So redistricting hearings and obviously major story in Texas has receded a little bit as it now grinds through the process.
Yeah.
But the redistricting hearings are taking place in El Paso, hearings on motions, challenging the new maps being folded into already going proceedings that were already underway on the 2021 maps that had been long delayed by various kinds of factors.
I think it's one of those things, if you follow this, I generally follow this stuff relatively closely. I mean, obviously, more than the average bear, but I mean, this one is particularly confusing. I mean, just in the sense of the way that the nature of the legal arguments and the movements that people have had to make and the fact that it's getting folded into ongoing case, it's just one of those things where, it's even more... I'm not going to say it's inscrutable, but it's even more challenging to sort of follow exactly who's saying what and why and where in this than it usually is.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, sort of the process is folding in on itself in a number of ways here. So, and I say folding rather than collapsing, but we'll see how that goes. But I think it is fair to say folding because of the lengths in the different judicial processes and the way that mid-decade redistricting from a legal perspective really complicated all of that even more.
Mm-hmm.
And then, another thing you probably noticed, we talked a lot last week about the Senate race in 2016 or 2 weeks ago now.
Yeah.
We missed last week about the Senate race in Texas in 2026. Fundraising reports came out as we record Thursday morning, I guess yesterday morning or late Tuesday night, something like that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are noticing, I'm getting, email messages or text messages from people out of state, pretty impressive numbers out of the gate.
Yeah.
For rookie statewide candidate, State Representative James Tallarico, raised $6.2 million in the first report of his candidacy.
Yeah. Which, as I understand, really only covered because of when he announced about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I'll say, we follow this up and everybody wants to make big deals out of things when they want to make big deals out of things. But as, some people who don't like to make big deal out of things just because it's, it's a lot of money. I mean, it's a lot of money to raise in 3 weeks. The question is it what's the kind of sustainability of the momentum?
I don't know.
Who
this,
knows?
But my suspicion is that, there was something, not as long a runway as others, but there was something of a runway to this announcement.
Yeah.
In terms of, the rumblings about this during the session, during the special, that we just talked that, Tallarico was going to look to do something, the Joe Rogan thing and all that. So, not to be overly naive about this. I mean, a lot of this was probably getting lined up.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, the numbers were good. There were a lot of small contributions, as I saw in the stuff that I read.
I have to be honest. I've looked deeper. Yeah. I mean, sort of the in-state, out-of-state numbers. I mean, one of the things about a candidate like that who has a really, notable social media presence is how much is he getting those donations from in-state contributions versus out-of-state? And that doesn't necessarily matter. Money's money, just to say it out loud. But in terms of, sort of gauging overall interest support, I mean, I think a lot of the articles that pointed out the fundraising also pointed out the numbers that we released, basically the week before the show that, still a large share of the Democratic electorate doesn't know who he is.
Right.
Huge share of the electorate doesn't know who he is. I mean, he needed that money.
Right.
I mean, so it's a start.
Yeah. And again, to be balanced about that. But, his numbers were about where All Red was at this point in the cycle.
Right.
In 2024. And All Red raised, I think, a little over four.
Yeah.
But all had money in the bank already, et cetera. So that's not really the main topic today. You know, I'm a little embarrassed. So, yeah, I don't remember what the in-state, out-of-state thing was, that. I looked at it. Now I don't recall because we're going to talk about other stuff. But wanted to flag it. Yeah. It's out there. And if you're following that story, you know, we did have fave unfaves for Tallarico and for All Red in the poll that we did at the end of August. All that stuff is at our website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And the interesting thing about that from the public opinion perspective is you can break that down by party, by age, by, you know, demographic groups that help you get a sense of, you know, where the starting point, the kind of baseline is for him. Kind of look at that in comparison to All Red, et cetera. You know, I think, you know, the next poll that we'll do in the next, you know, little bit will be interesting to see.
Yeah.
Now, that's going to be an interesting interval between August and October for the fave unfaves and where a lot of these candidates are. And, you know, we'll be expanding our list of fave unfaves in that poll for those of you who don't necessarily have to call. We're going to, you know, we're going to, it's going to be a pretty expansive list as based on what we have on the board right now. So, you know, as I said a minute ago, we really, you know, we kind of want to talk a little bit about the shutdown. We have, you know, some interesting data on that. That's not about the shutdown itself for the most part, but, you know, is, I think, good context for that. And if, you know, you want to talk about the context of this, it's all over the news. You know, if you follow this at all, you kind of know what the TikTok has been leading up to this, you know, yesterday and this, the first thing I heard when I kind of, when the radio went off this morning on the hour was the NPR lead saying government's still shut down, you know, failed, you know, another failed vote in the Senate. The leaders are talking. There's a lot of news coverage about, you know, the negotiations that are going on about the terms on the, which they're going to end this.
And the strategy to get there.
Doesn't look very favorable in terms of it ending soon, but I'm not there. And, you know, I think a lot of times the more successful these negotiations are not covered. People are not talking to reporters about it.
Seems to me.
That's
exactly right.
Now, you know, we also want to talk about, you know, there's a lot of things we can look at in terms of the impact on Texas, which is kind of more in our domain. There's a pretty good roundup. There's actually a few good roundups. So there's a lot out there, but a good one going into the shutdown or day of the impacted policy in geographic areas in Texas, in a Texas Tribune piece by Gabby Birnbaum and Marika Friedman at the Texas Tribune. And then both Birnbaum and Friedman have separate articles, both of which following up. There's something this morning that was quite good that you were flagging. But, you know, there's two kind of separate questions that we'll get into here. You know, the first question just that we can kind of round up, and I would point you to those articles, and you can help fill us in a little on this, is, you know, what is the impact structurally, institutionally on the ground in Texas?
Right.
But then, you know, how does the public think about it? What is the response? How will they notice? Those are – they're obviously – they affect each other. The first affects the second, and then maybe even a little vice versa. But certainly the conditions are going to be felt by people and may shape public opinion. How it feeds back and how they prioritize it is a separate question.
Yeah, I mean, there are...
But it's kind of clear, though, that it is going to be have an impact in Texas.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, your point is good, which is like, you know, these are on different timelines, you know, and so usually whatever, you know, whenever there's a government shutdown or the sniffings of a government shutdown, you and I usually get some calls and it's like specific, like, okay, what does this mean for Texas? Like right now? And the answer is like right now, not a ton per se, like in the sense of what people think about is like the scope of a government shutdown. And part of that is because there are certain functions that just keep going, right? So like, you know, Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid payments keep going out, you know, there's about 200,000, you know, Texans who are deployed by the Department of Defense. They're going to keep working. Right, because that's part of the contingency plan, right? So there is a certain aspect to this, which is like, okay, you know, the effect is not as necessarily like
universal and uniform.
Well, and it's not a shock and awe, right? So I mean, yes, like there's 130,000 federal civilian employees in Texas.
They don't shut down NORAD.
Yeah, but those 130,000 people all of a sudden like aren't, you know, they're not getting paid. They're not going, you know, they're going to have a hard time, you know, making rent, going to the grocery store. Like these things do have trickle effects, but it's sort of like, is it immediate? Not necessarily. And when I think in previous shutdown, you know, threats that we've talked about, there are things that, you know, will necessarily get affected, whether in Texas or elsewhere, in terms of like you think about like processing of things that the government needs to do, and that stuff just slows down or stops.
You know, people not being there to answer the phone or respond to your chats or emails, whatever.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing that, you know, I mean, it's easy to think of it in terms of like government benefits and services, but the government also does a lot of things, you know, for businesses, provides data, provides things that other entities run on and rely on. And as that stuff starts to jam up, over time, that's going to have a downstream consequence. But the main point is like, you know, it's not like the government shuts down and all of a sudden it's like, oh, you know, the stock market's going to tank. All these things are going to happen. Everything just, the lights shut off, right? And so that is to say, like, yes, there's an effect here. 130,000 people is a lot, you know, of people.
That's the federal civilian. That's the federal numbers, civilian federal members. Civilian employees and
right. And then, but I think the thing that's tricky on this one too, and, you know, we'll kind of keep going, but is, you know, there's a lot of unknowns here, right? I mean, currently right now, we don't know how the White House is planning to carry out the government shutdown. They've signaled as part of the messaging what they plan to do. And some of it is a mixture.
Part of the bargaining.
It's part of the bargaining, which we'll get to. But this sort of idea of, you know, they're very big headlines, you know, sort of holding up, you know, freezing federal funding in places like New York and it's a Democratic run states.
Yeah.
But ultimately, they're going to have to do, like, the pain is going to be felt more widespread, even if they're concentrated versions.
But also, you know, the OMB, Russell Vought, Project 2026, Project 2025, you know, threat that they will take this as an opportunity, not just to furlough people, but to fire them with the hope that they don't have to rehire them.
Yeah. And that's the sort of thing. We just don't know yet what that's going to look like and how much of that is going to be. Are they really going to do that? Is it really a negotiating strategy? Or are they going to do it and then it's going to be in court trial? So anyone who says right now, well, this is the effect of the shutdown, I'm like, we just kind of like, we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know that. I do think, you know, and again, you mentioned there are two articles, and I do want to point out kind of the other side of this because it's really important for Texas, and that's the thing that I think is here. So in, you know, at the Tribune, they also had this piece on what the Democratic side of this is, or the numbers behind it, which is
what their arguments and kind of and what they're asking for.
Yeah. So the Democratic, and we kind of talked about it, we should just do this real quick. But basically, what's going? Why don't you do this? You did this really well in the office. But what is going on here? The actual mechanics of this, right? Is that the ACA subsidies that the Democrats passed in 2021, which expanded the eligibility for these ACA tax credits, is set to expire, right? Okay. So the idea is that to keep government moving, we can pass a continuing resolution. And if we pass a continuing resolution, which keeps the funding levels essentially more or less where Republicans wanted, this is probably other cuts, I imagine.
Yeah.
But ultimately, that will allow the cuts to expire, and they're not in the next budget, which means there's no leverage for Democrats to put them back into the next budget. So they're taking this as their chance of having leverage to make sure that those subsidies continue on. That's what they're fighting for.
Right.
Okay.
So there's two pieces of consequences to that.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So just to note here why this is actually a really big deal in Texas, and I think this article really gets it. I certainly did not know this until I looked at this article.
Yeah,
it's really,
we were talking about this in the office. I mean, this is, you know, friends, colleagues, political contacts, you know, in the healthcare industry, in the health insurance, had been flagging this, you know. I mean, I had somebody kind of pull me aside at a social event, you know, probably 6 months, four or five months ago. Anyway, kind of going, hey, by the way, you know, this thing happens, it is going to have a massive impact. There's going to be a lot of people, and, you know, this, and they kind of lay that out in the piece.
Right. So this is the impact on Texas if those ACA subsidies were to expire. So basically, since 2021, when they expanded eligibility, the number of Texans using those ACA, or the number of Texans on the ACA using the enrollment mechanism, tripled from 1.3 million in 2021 to 3.9 million. That's a lot of people.
When we saw a real drop in the number of people without health insurance.
Right. The time period is longer, but it went from almost, you know, 25% to just a little under 17% over a little bit longer of a time period. But this is to say, like, a lot of times when, you know, you say like, oh, it's a big deal, and then you say, you know, it's like, oh, there's 130,000 people are going to lose their jobs. It's like, in Texas, with the number of people we have, it's a lot of people, but it's not a lot of people.
And regional distribution factors, right? You know, but areas, you know, where their military and government are heavier. Yeah.
But 4 million people is a lot of people.
Yeah.
Okay. So what does it mean in reality? You know, so the annual premium for a family of four enrolled in this coverage, but from 2021 to 25, dropped from about $3,700 to about $1,600. If the subsidies were to expire, it's going to jump back up almost immediately, like next month, is my understanding, to about $3,400.
So more than double.
It's going to more than double. And what's really, you know, I mean, really remarkable about this is that, you know, the expectation is that either due to, you know, loss of the subsidy or people kind of just walking away from the market, they said about 4 million Americans are going to drop coverage if these CRAX credits expire. Kaiser Family Foundation projects about 4 million Americans are going to drop coverage.
Yeah. And we're all adults here. We can say Kaiser Family Foundation is, you know, kind of a
But as you said,
positioned in the healthcare space in a certain way, and I do think that this was kind of a combination of some survey research they did and projections.
Yeah, because you, yeah, because it's
based
almost
on use patterns,
almost so necessary. But yeah. I mean, to your point before, it's like this is not deviating from the view on the ground of people who work in the healthcare space in
right,
Texas.
Right, this is not. Yeah.
So just to make the point. So they expect that about 4 million Americans are going to drop coverage if these credits expire. About 1 million of those are expected to come from Texas.
Yeah.
A quarter. So, like, it's a pretty big, big fight for here. I mean, both yeah. in terms of the fact that Texas relies on a lot of federal dollars, which we talked about, you know, which are going to slow down and trickle to or dry up or stop
right.
based on the government shutdown, whatever cuts get made on top of that. But also, there's this other side to this, which is if they do end up sort of pushing through a continuing resolution, it does mean the 26% of this group of, you know, 4 million is going to, from Texas, is going to probably drop off the rolls.
Yeah.
Our uninsurance rate is going to go back up. And, you know, ultimately what this does raises a bunch of other, host of other issues like, uh-oh, are the rural hospitals in trouble now?
Well, you know, it is. Yeah. I was just going to say, it intersects a lot of interesting issues that have been, you know, I use the term too much, kind of percolating out there.
Yeah.
You know, some of those things that you see kind of underneath the data, it's like, wait, is that there? And you look again
right.
and... But the health, you know, and I was talking to some folks. I was at a health insurance industry, gave a talk this week, which was thanks for having me, folks. But as always, fun and interesting, learned a lot. But also, you know, just the sense that in public opinion, you know, healthcare kind of, you know, pokes its head above the hedge and then it kind of goes back down
yeah.
again. But it doesn't really go away. And, you know, and it makes you wonder, you know, and again, all the things we talk about, it's a very crowded environment out there. It doesn't move the needle in a lot of the obvious ways,
yeah.
although there's a couple of ways it has that we'll talk about.
But, you know,
but it's really out there.
But you know, it does when it, I mean, the thing with, you know, for years and years of this, and we've constantly, you always see this, you know, persistent share of people who highlight the importance of healthcare, who say it's a big problem. And it's funny, you know, one of the arguments, you know, I was reading in all the coverage of this, sort of against the continuation of the subsidies, and some are more or less, you know, reasonable. You know, they're all are
yeah.
what they are. And same thing for the continuation argument. But one of the arguments against it was basically saying, you know, there's too many people on these insurance subsidies who aren't making, like, who aren't actually filing any claims. And it's kind of like, well, that's kind of what insurance
yes.
is, right? You know, at the same time, you know, it's kind of like,
right.
you know, so, but you're kind of left with this sort of thing where it's like, well, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, yeah, and there's a lot of policy discussions that I am not qualified to discuss about.
Yeah.
That have been going on for a long time about preventative care and, you know, public health issues and, you know, et cetera.
But, oh, no,
but the idea that, well, they're not using it, why should they pay for it, kind of misses the point.
Well, it misses the point.
I understand what you're
yeah,
saying,
well,
and I think that's correct.
Well, and I think that's right, and it misses the point. But
certainly
the point, but
persuasive
the point is that
me.
But the reason is because not everybody's facing a catastrophic medical situation every year, every other year. They're not facing a medical situation that requires, you know, significant outlay of expenses, whether individually or through one's insurance. But when it does, and when one of those things does come up, it's a big problem for most people. And
yeah.
I think that's part of why, no matter what, you know, yeah, we would never expect to see 70% of people saying healthcare is a crisis in American listening. You know, it really was like an insane crisis.
Yeah.
But the fact that there's always 10 to 15% is a reflection of the fact that when a healthcare crisis comes up, it's a pretty big problem for most people.
It becomes, yeah, yeah. I mean, in our, you know, the artless language of the social sciences, you know, it becomes salient.
It becomes very salient very quickly.
Yeah. And in a very direct way. Okay. So let's telescope back out.
Yeah.
We'll, you know, we're going to
yeah,
circle
yeah.
back to this a little bit. You know, so let's, you know, you dug something out that was interesting that added to this pile of data that we've got on this. And like, we should start with that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, looking at the views of the impact of reduced federal spending on Texas, which, mm-hmm. you know, is a pretty good rough general barometer. And just the background, you know, we had a battery of questions mm-hmm. where, you know, we looked, you know, starting, I think, in February was the first time we asked, I think. In
or
which
April.
Maybe April, but in which we say, you know, here's some things that basically the Trump administration was either prominently promising or beginning to implement mm-hmm. early in the term, and then ask people, well, how do you think this is going to impact Texas?
Yeah, and I mean, just to be exactly what it was, you know, we're asking about, you know, reduction in federal spending, reduction in the federal workforce, the deportation of undocumented immigrants
right.
were sort of the main focus here because these were the sort of the marquee policies. You know, we have other questions about tariffs. I think tariffs
yeah.
is on that one too.
Yeah,
but one
is.
Of the things that we really wanted to know was, okay, this is going on. You have personal views, but do you think this is going to be good or bad for the state?
Right. And for those that are out there going, hey, look, they're not really reducing federal spending. Noted.
Yeah, right.
They're redistributing. But, you know, we started this battery sort of at the time. We were trying to figure out, you know, this is what, you know, if you think back to what seems like a million years ago in February or right. even late January, you know, the Trump administration came out of the barrel pretty hot.
Yeah.
You know, he signed, you know, record number of executive orders on his first day of office. They were clearly moving quickly. It was part of the, you know, the narrative of the early Trump administration. That was part of the, yeah. you know, like at this point, it was gauging expectations. So let's talk about the federal spending data.
Right. So overall, you know, in let's see, what year would we do this? This was June. Yes, this was the June poll. So overall, you know, 36% of Texans thought it would either be very good or somewhat good for Texas to have this reduction in federal spending. 46% said it would either be somewhat bad or very bad, right? 8% said no impact, 10% didn't know, which makes sense. I mean, honestly, yeah. we're asking for something a little bit complicated here. But the point is, a plurality of voters that time said, yeah, it's probably going to be bad for Texas. Now, while there's, you know, obviously going to be partisan patterns here, you know, there's some... You know, some, you know, I'd say clear, but not necessarily overly symmetrical patterns of partisanship, yeah. right? So Democrats are much more likely to see reduced federal spending as a bad thing for the state.
Not shocking.
Yeah. Their negative expectations were significantly more pronounced, though, than the positive expectations of Republicans. And I think that's important. We're trying to figure out what the connection.
Yeah. And that's what we mean by like not being symmetrical.
Yeah. Right. right. So among Republicans, 64% said this would be very good, right? Well, among Democrats, 54% said it would be. I'm sorry. No, that's not right.
37% of Republicans said right. very good, but 64% said be good. Generally positive.
Yeah, yeah. So a little bit, you know, a little bit more than half of the Republicans just said it would be good, said it would be very good. Among Democrats, 80% said it would be bad, with 54%. So a majority of all Democrats said it would be very bad.
Right.
Right.
In other words, just, you know, we can, the yeah. numbers can be another.
Yeah, no, for
you know,
sure.
Democrats were, you know, intensely convinced it was going to be bad. Republicans were less intensely convinced it was going to be good.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Now, I think the key thing to note here, because again, as you pointed out, this was in a period in which, you know, the Trump administration had come out of the gate, Doge was firing, they were like putting up the yeah. website, showing the cuts, right? And it's worth noting that, you know, again, 46% who saw the cuts in federal spending as bad in Texas, again, and that was in June. That was a huge increase over April. Only 32% of Texans thought these cuts would be bad for Texas in April. So it went up 14 points. The plurality in April thought these would be good.
Yeah.
So again, out of the gate, starts out, again, more Texans, 47% compared to 32%, right? Thought these would be good for Texas as opposed to bad for Texas. Jump ahead just a little bit from, you know, again, from August, no, I'm sorry, April, I didn't bath months,
yeah.
April to June, right?
There you go.
And it flips.
Yeah.
And so the reason we just bring this up is to say that, you know, even at the time, just a little bit ago, when sort of Texans in particular were faced with this question of whether like reductions in federal spending would be good or bad for the state, they'd already flipped to saying, yeah, no, I don't think that's good for us.
Yeah. So that'd be good. Like our colleague Darren Shaw is always talking about, you know, he has all these interesting views of these views of spending that when you really push people on it, they're not.
Right.
You know, the government spends too much thing is kind of soft.
Right. Because I mean, like a lot of things, it's like, well, depends on what you're talking about. Spending yeah, exactly. on what, you know, and that's part of the piece here. So, I mean, I think, you know, we'll get into some more discussion later. We can kind of come back to this, but it does raise the question about the political efficacy maybe of the White House's approach to using cuts, sort of retaliatory freezes and cuts and sort of mass layoffs as a strategy to pressure Democrats in the yeah. legislature, right? Because if the goal here is to basically
in the Congress,
know, in the Congress, right?
Yeah, well, it's the legislative branch. We're teaching American politics.
I know, we're teaching American politics. Right
I'm
now.
Doing that all the time now.
But if the goal here is to attach the shutdown blame to Democrats, you know, this might be challenging because you might be already picking up negative attitudes about these cuts they've right. already made to government spending.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this also speaks to the, you know, we also have an impact from that same set of polling on. Results on the impact of Texas of reducing the size of the federal workforce, which mm-hmm. is also a piece of this. The numbers are very similar. We won't repeat the numbers. You can find them on the website very easily. So that kind of plays into this, you know, and it does, as a side point, kind of raise the question ultimately, you know, of, you know, who is the prime constituency for this, you know, and where is the, you know, who... You know, who does the administration, you know, decide is going to be or think is going to be the best audience for this? And probably more subtly, who cares about what audience within the administration? Because I think that at the end of the day, the policy, political philosophy, infrastructure in the Trump White House, mm-hmm. Russell Vought, people mm-hmm. like that, you know, they are not as targeted on Donald Trump's personal political success as Donald Trump is.
Yeah, that's a good
point. Or even Republicans in Congress.
Right. I mean, right. This is an opportunity for people like that who have always wanted to cut lots of government programs to basically take an axe.
This is their moment.
This is their moment. And so if given the opportunity, they may go for that. I think, you know, the only sort of counterpoint I can make in terms of what we're just talking about is it's possible that some of those negative perceptions were wrapped up in Doge and Elon Musk. And
I think that's a good point.
And I think, you know, we do have to sort of caveat this to say that there was other stuff going on in that period that people could have issue with. At the same time, just to say, you know, it didn't take very long for Texans to say, you know, maybe all these cuts aren't good for us.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
when and again, not uniformly,
but it's out there, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, look, I kind of took a peek as I was putting some of the data together for this. You know, you still have a familiar pattern when you look at those numbers by conservative intensity.
Right.
And a little less so, interesting, but still there, but a little less so by party identification intensity. But certainly the conservative intensity is pretty more or less linear here. That is, the more conservative you are, you think of yourself, the more likely you are to go, cut it. Cut them all.
Yeah,
you know, who cares? There's too many of them.
This is going to be good for everybody.
Which, you know, again, not it shouldn't be shocking.
Right.
You know, to anybody. Right. So, all right. So let's move on in the data piece then. So other things that we have a little more recent that speak to this, you know, in some ways more, not directly to the shutdown, but more directly to the issues that are being promoted here by some members of the administration. It's a pretty good transition from this thing we were just talking about, actually.
Good.
That is, you know, we've been dining out, really. I mean, I've used them a lot lately and stuff I've been doing on the road in the last few weeks. You know, we had a battery of questions that we've been asking now for, about a year, I think. Maybe a little longer.
Yeah, actually.
Where we ask, you know, we give people, and you've heard us talk about this if you listen to the podcast, give them a set of economic issues and ask them, you know, how concerned are you about that? So, you know, the overall arc of this is, you know, we have all of our general tracking on the economy in which we say, you know, national economy, state economy, personal conditions, you know, better or worse than a year ago, basically. And then after people make those kind of judgments, you say, well, how about some specific things? How concerned are you about these things? And we have items in there for the national debt and the federal deficit. And they're, you know, fairly high. They kind of define the beginning of the middle of the pack, right?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, just focus on the share of Texans who said that they're very concerned about these economic issues. 47% in August said they were very concerned about the national debt. 44% about the federal budget deficit. That put those two items in terms of we rank order, like the 14 or 12 dozen or so items that we ask about. Those rank those as the fourth and fifth highest on the list in terms of the very concerned. Now, what's above that is still, you know,
significantly above it. Theme of the podcast 3 weeks ago, I think.
Yeah, the cost of housing. The cost of housing, price of consumer goods. But notably, and we'll kind of make swing around to this, the cost of healthcare. So, you know, whereas 47% and 44% of the national debt and the federal budget deficit were very concerning to them, 64% said the same about, you know, the price of food and consumer goods, 56% about the cost of housing, but 63% about the cost of healthcare, about the same as food,
right?
Which has been a big issue. And I think there was some recent data just came out. I think I saw it in the Axios. It was talking about, you know, the sort of the price of like the grocery basket thing.
Yeah,
people's perceptions about like the basically their money's not going far enough.
Yeah, it was the Axios vibes poll.
Yeah, it was their vibes.
Which, you know, vibes, it seems to me like branding.
Are we done with that?
Branding derived in 2022, but
yeah, it feels like it.
We like our friends at Axios. So.
But what's also interesting here too, and I think this is a really important point in this whole discussion, is when we look at, you know, those attitudes about concern broken down by partisanship.
Right.
Now, not surprisingly, we see a lot
And again, focused on the deficit.
Right, on the deficit. Well, a little bit. I mean, I was going to say, if we look at just Republican attitudes, you know, the number one concern, in terms of very concerned, was it was the cost of healthcare. Shocker, sorry, you know. Second was the national debt. It was at 48%. So we'll say those are statistically indistinguishable. At 41% was the federal budget deficit.
Yeah.
So this is just to say, you know, what's interesting here, just as a point out, is that, you know, while essentially this is a little bit of a fight that's sort of settling on government spending and healthcare spending, when you ask Republicans, you know, what are you concerned about when we look at these different sort of issues in the economy, the two things that rise to the top are actually the national debt and the cost of healthcare.
Yeah. And the national debt, we should say, is tied with price of
consumer goods. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Which is interesting, right? And it's about what the struggle here is. And then federal budget deficit is just a little bit below that,
right.
I think, you know, after the tie for second place. So, yeah, and I think the other element that I think is interesting when you look at the partisan structure and you throw Democrats in the mix there is that, you know, Democrats also register, you know, concern about the deficit.
Right.
You know, even though they're also, you know, more concerned about budget cuts. And this is a common talking point, I mean, among non-Democrats, like, you know, Democrats want it both ways.
Right.
But I think, you know, I wish, you know, I haven't looked at the trend data, and I'd want to look at the trend data over a longer period of time, actually. Yeah. But I mean, I think it's pretty striking that actually the overall levels of concern about the deficit are pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
And in the August poll, Democratic concern was slightly more intense than Republicans, right? 46% very concerned, 41% of 46% of Democrats very concerned versus 41% of Republicans. Now, for a subgroup, that's not a very big difference.
Yep.
You know, fair enough to say, but it is kind of clearly a gap in one direction. I should have looked, I need to look at the trend data there more. And also, you know, with Republicans running the federal government, that's going to be a big piece of that.
This is where I wish if we'd been asking this set of questions for a longer time period, what you'd obviously want to be able to do is sort of, you know, look across the different administrations and see, you know, I mean, look, I don't think it would take a – I don't need to look at a bunch of public opinion. I'm putting my hands to my temple. I'm doing the thing, you know, but it's like I don't need to like read into the tea leaves to say, you know, it's probably the case that when Democratic administrations have been in office, Republicans have expressed more concern about the deficit than the debt.
Right? And there is something –
and Democrats less.
And there's there's the other interesting dynamic here, which I think we talked about a few weeks ago, but I kind of raised again. It's kind of near top of mind because I talked about it a bit in the talk I gave earlier this week that – you know, the closer you get to home, in other words, when you go from evaluations of the national economy, evaluations of the state economy, evaluations of household, the partisanship effects get a little different as you get closer, right? So, for example, you know, the Republican assessments of, you know, whether the economy is improved or, you know, economic conditions have improved or not over the last year get less positive as you go from national to Texas, to my personal conditions.
Right.
And they don't get necessarily a lot more negative. They get a little more static.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
And so less positive and a little more, well, you know, it's about the same.
The national economy is doing great. I'm doing the same.
Yeah. You know, which is an interesting thing.
Yeah.
Right. So that's, you know, gives us some sense of, you know, I mean, we talked about where, I mean, you kind of alluded to, you know, not to put words in your mouth, Republicans may be overplaying their hand a little bit in terms of the, we're just going to go and start firing people or cutting costs. And Republicans, well, you know, Texans, maybe not so much. On the other hand, you know, Democrats have to be, I think, a little careful that they do have a big part of their constituency saying, yeah, I am kind of worried about these big structural economic problems in the country. Now, the salience numbers, et cetera, mean that they, you know, I don't want to overplay that.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that, you know, it's not, and part of this is just dispelling, you know, the obvious partisan combat of, you know, Republican opinion leaders saying, yeah, Democrats, they just want to spend.
Yeah.
And that's been part of the national messaging in response to the Democratic emphasis on restoring the health care cuts.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, I'm just saying it out loud, but it's funny saying it out loud. I think it's challenging to say, like, all these Democrats want to do is spend, and we just want them to pass the continuing resolution that would keep spending where it is.
Right. Yeah.
Which is like, okay. You know, I mean, this is where it gets into the whole messaging and the framing piece of this, you know, which I think is sort of.
And there's no lack of, you know, disingenuity.
Yeah,
in some context.
No. Not at all.
I'm not indulging in both sidism. I mean, look, the cuts, as we've said, the cuts in healthcare are real cuts in healthcare.
Yeah.
And are going to have a real impact.
Right.
There's no two ways about that.
Right. No, that's right.
But, you know, nonetheless, you know, in policy terms, Democratic framing is focused mostly on healthcare so far.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were having a conversation on the phone yesterday. It's like, for now. You know.
And that's part of the – we'll come back to that. That's part of the Democratic challenge in all this.
Right. And to a lesser extent on, you know, the Trump administration exerting its will over Congress.
Right.
You know, with the cooperation of congressional Republicans, which, you know, I think to some degree – you know, has the virtue of being true.
Right.
You know, and this issue that we've talked about in here and we've been talking about in our teaching lately, you know, the use of rescissions and executive orders to override congressionally authorized spending. And it is interesting that the, you know, the Democrats are leaning in the healthcare direction more and more, but this other institutional argument is still
that's the other big
out
thing
there. But we do know that the share of those that are very concerned about healthcare costs, as you said, was second only to concern about prices.
Right. And this is clearly like, you know, I mean, this is a vulnerable spot for him. I mean, you know, we ask in these, you know, in our polling, we ask in addition to sort of the general job approval numbers for, you know, all of the statewide officials and the president, we also ask about Trump's specific job performance on about 17 or so policy areas. Sometimes it gets a little bigger, a little bit smaller, depending on what's going on. And Trump's worst ratings were on healthcare.
Yeah, and that's not new.
That's not new, and
it's at or near the bottom pretty consistently. And again, we've only done a few of these because guys haven't been in office again that long.
Right, but it's notable because, you know, look, overall, only 27% of Texans approved of the job he's doing on healthcare, 49% disapproved.
And that is low.
That is very low. I mean, look, this is like, you know, for all intents and purposes, until it's not, this is a Republican state.
Yeah.
So 27-49 is not good. You know, this included obviously comparatively mediocre reviews from Republicans. So 52% of majorities still approved, 12% disapproved, 29% were neutral, and 7% didn't know. Now, when I say that they are comparatively mediocre at 52% approval, for comparison, his top rated issue among Texas Republicans was, of course, border security. 90% approved there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of room between 52 and 90 is what we could say.
It's not that his constituents are unpleasable.
No.
Right.
No. Right.
I mean, I think they're, you know, they're willing to give him the benefit of the doubt on things.
Well, but I think, you know, you were making that point about the Democratic messaging being on healthcare and to a lesser extent, you know, the Trump administration exerting its will in Congress. And that to me picks up on the other big sort of thing we've seen in public opinion recently, which is Democratic attitudes coalescing around sort of a focus on Trump.
Yeah.
And we see that in the most important problems of the country, most important problems we see in the state. So for Democrats, whether I mean, to you're saying this about the Trump administration and who they're trying to speak to and satisfy. But it's the same question for the Democrats here, which is they're also in an election year. They're also going into primaries. I mean, that's a big part of the Schumer discussion right now. And, you know, they're looking at this and they're going, look, people are concerned about health care. Our people are concerned about health care. Other people who aren't our people are concerned about health care. And you know what unifies our base more than anything right now? The president.
Yeah.
So if we focus on, you know, him sort of pushing Congress around, you know, you can change Congress if you want. I mean, it's a good, you can see what they're thinking here, you know, when you
put if you're a member of Congress right now, you know, even given this variance we were just talking about in Republican approval of Trump and different issue areas, you know, he's still in better standing than what we now have to say is just the perpetually beleaguered legislative branch. You know, congressional approval in August was 27 approve, 53% disapprove, and that was actually, you know,
not bad,
kind of good for them.
Yeah, not too.
You know,
bad.
It's in the high end of the band.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, the approval was higher than it's been. Generally.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it moves around a lot. I mean, they were as high as 35, I think, right after the election in November in our December poll, and that December poll was generally, you know, people were, you know, we've been talking about this on our December polls. People were just generally in kind of a better mood.
Yeah, I think probably because everybody
this past December and the election was over, we
left him alone for a little bit, you know.
Right, exactly.
No, but I think, you know, it's one of the funny things about all of this is, you know, the idea here right now is there's this, you know, they call it the blame game and who's going to get saddled with the blame from this. And it is really interesting. I mean, just kind of looking at these numbers and just sort of sitting back and going, you know, so how much of a hit could Congress even take?
Right.
You know, as a body and as an institution here, you know, I mean, ultimately, they're so. They have such low regard among the public to begin with. It's almost like, you know, is this really going to drive down attitudes much further? And, you know, I mean, I don't think that necessarily matters so much as to say, I'm not sure that there's a huge amount of pressure on Congress right now because, you know, the public is going to be like, Congress, you're not doing this right.
Right. You know, so they already think they're, you know, but, you know, how low could they go? You know, if we go back to through, you know, if we look at the time series of the total approval numbers for Congress, overall approval numbers, you know, the low point is 19. So, you know, we know they can go that low.
Right. They can go at least that low.
Right. And, you know, and again, the partisan numbers are interesting. I mean, only another 52%, only 52% of Republican voters, you know, with their party in the majority in both chambers, albeit a tissue paper thin majority in the House, only 52% approve of Congress, while 24% disapprove and, you know, 20% have this neutral rating. You know, Democrats, of course, express lopsided disapproval. with independents kind of in the middle, a little more mildly, but, you know, like everyone else, still predominantly disapproving.
Yes, I mean, you know, independent disapproval has been upticking. And this is, and let's say, this is the sort of thing that is tailor-made to increase independent disapproval.
Right.
You know.
And yeah, again, I mean, they, you know, they already have, they, you know, they have a chip on their shoulder about institutions and government.
Well,
you know. I mean, look, which is, we've talked about this before. It's kind of inherent in the true independent profile.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, this is also a moment we should flag for people in there.
Yeah.
There was an Axios National, and I don't know if you saw it, piece. I think it was in just the regular Axios, but I'm not Axios AM, you know, where some poll had parsed out independence, and it really illustrated the drum we're beating on independence here all the time inadvertently, and that they took the 3-point independent number and broke it down.
Yeah. And then it's like, oh.
You know, and they try to differentiate, you know, I don't know, active but hostile independence, passive, not involved independent. It was, you know, it was interesting in that way, but the point I'm making is that it, you know, it did recognize that, I can't remember what cheeky term they used, that there were, you know, people saying they're independents that are really just cloaked Democrats and Republicans.
Yeah, I think somebody wrote a book about that like
30
years ago.
Yeah, a while ago.
Yeah.
All right, so, well, you know, a little bit. We're, you know, we're, we've been going on for a while, surprisingly, not. You know, I mean, I think what this points to among, you know, there's a lot of things we could pull out of this, and I'll just give you an open-ended to pull something out.
Okay.
But, you know, we do have to say, going in, congressional leaders in the White House, not in the mood for compromise.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think the White House seems to feel that they have the upper hand. Now, they often think that. They're often right, but they're not always right. You know, and I think we're seeing that in the way that, again, I think as we've talked through this, part of that impression is a function of the posturing and the readiness of some of the non-elected officials in the administration to execute an agenda that they want to execute. And they're seeing this, you know, while others are saying, is this a political problem? They are seeing basically an opportunity.
Yeah, it's an opportunity.
You know, and, you know, for their part, Democrats, for all the tough talk, are in a bind with no real good choices. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was the New York Times Daily podcast yesterday, which I listened to on the road driving back from San Antonio, you know, had a bit of, you know, they kind of lay out the thing, and then they, it was an interesting thing in terms of some of the things we've talked about for the class, actually, you know, that the first part of the podcast is them in the studio, and then the second half, or maybe one third, two thirds, is them walking around Congress at different parts of the day as the shutdown was happening, talking to people. And they talked to Schumer, and Schumer is almost, to my mind, that is, you know, Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer in the Senate, was almost too frank in that way that Schumer can be about where the advantages and the disadvantages were. But, you know, they're saying, look, you know, in March, you know, we decided to go along with the CR because it seemed like it was the right thing to do at the time.
Yeah.
And we were worried that they would go in and they would, you know, do all these things. Well, now they've shown that they will do this anyway. And by these things, you know, indiscriminate firing, this kind of speaks to this legislative executive branch piece from a partisan, from the Democratic perspective. It goes, and now we are not going to go along with it, and it's the right thing to do now. And we have leverage. He actually, and that's a close paraphrase. He used the term leverage. I was like, hey, Chuck, you're not like talking to guys off the record. They're recording this. But nonetheless, you know, it speaks to where they are in terms of him, I think, if you give him some credit, thinking about what the audience, what his audience is. But, you know, to my mind, there's so much uncertainty because of the fact that there are people in the Trump administration who are going to, you know, who are not going to back down based on the political calculations that will sometimes drive these things. They're just going to execute.
Well, I think the question then becomes is, does that, you know, what does that execution do? So to me, let me just say real quick.
Yeah.
Setting aside whether or not, you know, there's a deal to be made in the next, you know, 24, 48, you know, whatever number of hours, there's just something going on behind the scenes that we just can't know about. And let's say this, you know, extends out for some period of time. You know, it's hard for me not to feel like the thing that makes this move is the idea that the public has settled on who to blame, and which is what is a huge part of this.
Right.
And so I guess what I don't know is, yes, those administration officials are taking this as an opportunity to push forward on these goals. The question then becomes, okay, how does the public react to that?
Yeah.
Because I think, you know, in normal circumstances, you know, this whole, the whole idea of even a blame game, I'm making the quotes here, is almost insane. I mean, just to say real quick, right? Republicans have control of the House, they have control of the Senate, they have control of the presidency. There is no blame game. Yeah, I mean, there's that clip of Trump from, like, you know, whatever, 30 years ago saying that essentially when there's a shutdown, it's the president's fault.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff out there, which I think Democrats are going to spend a lot of money running.
Except this is, it's really, I'm sitting here nodding.
But, well, I have another side. Let me finish. Yeah. Let me just finish. Now, normally, I think that would kind of be like, it's a look, you can try to blame the minority party for the government shutdown, but, like, that's a heavy lift.
Yeah.
However, two things. Number one, Trump is unique in of his own class when it comes to the heavy lift of communicating, you know, things that might be difficult to communicate or seem, you know, not consistent.
Even in the fact of them being at odds with some of the fundamental kind of facts.
Yeah. Right. It does not obviously is not fundamental. The other key thing here for me that sort of makes that calculation not so obvious is the Democratic opposition or the Democrats as an opposition party are so fractured and really leaderless. And I'm sorry to Senator Schumer, but so leaderless at
this
point.
I'm sure he appreciates that.
Yeah, well, I don't think he cares. So just about me personally, but so leaderless at this point that creates, you know, this vacuum that I think, you know, Democrats, I think, are consistently finding themselves behind the eight ball on everything. Yeah. And it's on all messaging because, you know, really for Republicans, the messaging comes from the top down and everybody knows what it is the second it happens, right?
Yeah. And they, you know.
And they follow suit. The Democrats do not have that. I mean, and even the whole way you lay it out and the reality of, you know, well, you know, back earlier in the year, you know, the politics, just in reality, the politics dictated that the Democrats would be in a bad position if they did anything to create a shutdown or to contribute to it. Here, the calculation has, you know, seemingly changed for them.
In Schumer's view. We should note that, you know, the other thing that Schumer left out is, yeah, I got the living crap beat out of me for that, taking that position from...
And I'll say
the vocal wing of my party.
And I'll say, I think from just a pure politics standpoint, I still think that was the right position to take at the time. And this may or may not turn out to be the right position for Democrats to take to achieve whatever their goals are at this point in time. But even just saying that Democrat goals, whatever those are, it's like, well, the really only Democratic goal we can talk about is like maybe retaking the House.
Yeah.
That's about all that's on offer here. And I think there is something about the strategy and the focus on healthcare cuts, loss of subsidies, especially given the nature of the way that the party, you know, coalition is changing. I mean, we just talked about here in Texas, right? I mean, this is a very much a majority Republican congressional delegation. If they succeed in creating more seats that should be Republican, I mean, look, ultimately, they're going to have to explain these healthcare cuts if they happen.
Right.
I mean, Democrats are going to try to make them, but that's a very disaggregated effort.
And it's diffuse and there's a lot of, again, there's just a lot of uncertainty there. Well, so, and I, you know, which leads me to say, look, the Democrats do not have a good choice here.
No.
You know, that is part, it's inherent in, you know, both being the minority party, most obviously, but also the difficulty of their own internal coalitional politics.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing is going to be then not so much, you know, I mean, well, one, it's how long does this last? As it plays out, where does the public allot blame? And trust me, there'll be plenty of pollsters, including us, asking to try to figure out where people see – who people see as, you know, responsible.
Where responsibility – who, if they're assigning responsibility. And
if
how,
it goes on, you know, people's perceptions of the negative consequences and impacts, such as they are, right? You know, and that stuff all kind of matters. But the other thing is like, you know, do the Democrats hold together?
Yeah.
That's really, I mean, when you, most of the strategy stuff that I'm reading in these days are kind of like, well, you know, the Republicans know who they're talking to.
Yeah.
They know exactly who they're trying to peel off.
Because in the Senate, basically these, you know, the vote that failed here, they're coming up five votes short.
Right.
And we've seen this movie.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, in some sense you could say, I mean, outside of everything else that's about this movie, you'd say this is kind of how it's supposed to happen. They're supposed to come together and figure out, you know, what that looks like. But I mean, the question is, can those Democrats hold together? Do they want to? I mean, I've been sort of seeing the idea that some number of them are retiring, being used in both directions.
Yeah.
You know, is that they might vote with them because of that. They might not, you know, and that's all, again, remains to be seen. But I will say, you know, I do think even having said all that and sort of acknowledging, I think the Democrats' weak choice, weak overall positioning, I do still think it, regardless, it's a heavy lift for the president with majorities in both chambers of Congress to say this is their fault.
Well, and I think that if you think about what the outcomes look like.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, I'm always loath to think, well, we're thinking of this and they're not. And so I don't think that. And I was just going to, in the more affirmative way of saying that, I mean, I think this is baked in, but you know, if you kind of game it out.
Yeah.
Right. So the shutdown goes on for some indeterminate period of time.
Mm-hmm.
It ends. Just setting aside the fact that, you know, something catastrophic happens or some external event intervenes to aggravate mm-hmm. the conditions of the shutdown or not. And, yeah. You know.
But that's an important point.
But it's a big
point.
Thing. A plane crash, a national disaster, something that can be either definitely or even plausibly linked to the shutdown.
Right.
You know, it raises the stakes for both sides, changes the incentives for negotiating mm-hmm. something, you know, et cetera. But, you know, I mean, to your point, I mean, one could argue, I think, that, okay, shutdown ends, the Democrats essentially lose.
Yeah.
You know, they weaken in the Senate, or they make a bad deal or whatever,
right.
and the health care cuts happen anyway, then they get to argue, well, look, we fought this. And then if there is a political backlash, if people do feel the health care cuts
mm-hmm.
and it's not distract, that's not diluted or distracted
yeah.
away from by something else, then that kind of helps in terms of an anti-incumbent argument.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, in the fall.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's easy for us to be focused on the primaries right now, but, you know, in the fall elections, what we're talking about by then maybe that does help. And so it becomes reinforcing to the traditional expected dynamic in
right.
this configuration of the president's out-party gaining seats.
Yeah.
The out-party gaining seats in the midterms, the president not on the ballot. If they do succeed in restoring the health care cuts, well, then they get to campaign on doing that.
Yeah.
Now, some Republicans that you know,
yeah.
by the time of the general election, everybody will be campaigning on that.
Yeah.
You know, again, whatever the truth of the matter, doesn't really matter. You know, it's irrelevant at that point. And so there is kind of a, you know, if you look at it that way, unless they just kind of blow it in some big way.
Yeah.
You know, there is some advantage to be gained in this context by Democrats.
Yeah. And I think, you know, look. An important caveat that you raise there is the fact the election's a long ways away.
All kinds of, yeah.
I mean, so let's just, you know, everybody, you know, it's like this is sort of the nature of this. Everybody's got to take a deep breath and go, okay, wait a minute. So when is the election? No, the candidate filing deadline.
Yeah.
Is not.
We don't even know everybody's running to
yeah,
recap some of our points from a couple of weeks
now.
Ago. Yeah.
And so the idea that, you know, I mean, there's a couple things. I mean, one is just a general thing, which is to say, look, this is a long ways away. A lot's going to happen in between now and then. And then another thing that I think, you know, I'm interested in, you know, you're probably interested in, even though we haven't talked about this directly, is, you know, the way that attention is distributed these days is interesting. You know, I was reading something somewhere kind of talking about, you know, sort of a lot of the new sort of AI video technology and stuff, and was talking mm-hmm. about, you know, sort of the attention economy, right?
Yeah.
And how all these, you know, all these sort of different kinds of businesses and entities are propping up, basically to keep your eyeballs, ears, whatever, attention to whatever their platform of choice is with whatever it is that is going to keep you there, real, made up, whatever. That's an interesting thing of itself, whatever, you know. But I think it is also speaks to the fact that, like, you know, we do notice that, like, these things that were big political stories, it's like, well, is it a big story? Now, some of that might just be the volume, right? I mean, there's so many things going on. How do you pay attention to what, you know? So I think that's one piece of this. But the other piece is, like, you know, and we talked about it a couple times, like, you know, I think Trump has the effect of polarizing attention, where some people are, like, in everything. They're reading everything every day. They want to know about every move, every time the court says something or whatever, or they want to see what he succeeded on, or they want to see what's moving forward, or what the next executive order is, or how he's pushing on the colleges or whatever, right? You know, and then some people are just like, screw this. I am out.
Not good for my mental health.
Not good for my mental
health.
And I think the people who are more all in, honestly, and you know, maybe unfortunately, are the people who already have pretty strong views.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so none of this is likely to really, you know.
Those are mutually reinforcing habits.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so,
characteristics. Yeah.
And so what you're left with is, you know, the people who might be most, you know, potentially persuadable by whatever facts they determine to be in evidence that define the situation and others, you know, they're probably the people like least likely to be paying attention to this stuff in a way. And that's something just to say, that's actually like, you know, in some ways that's new, you know, in terms of just the intensity of it because of all these other things, but also totally normal because the election is going to be next fall, you know, there's gonna be a lot of campaigns. There's going to be tons and tons of money spent to get on those same platforms that people are looking at and to put, you know, information in front of them. But it's not right now.
Yeah. At what point do people who don't normally pay attention to this start paying attention?
So they're getting exposed.
And
to
then them. When they do, where are we in the trajectory of this? And what is it that, makes an impression.
Yeah. I mean, it's a weird way to kind of end this, but it's almost like, so maybe none of this matters. I mean, not like doesn't. I'm just joking. Right. I'm just joking. But I mean, in the political sense, in the sense of the trajectory of the overall arc that we're on right now and sort of heading towards the next election cycle and all that, you know, this may be a big story. It may be a blip.
Yeah. And look, I mean, it's a little like to beat another dead horse, what we've been saying about Senate polling and the Senate race. Mm-hmm. Oh. It's not that, you know, it's easy for us to kind of go, it doesn't really matter. It's not going to resemble the outcome. I mean, look, it matters. It tells you something. But, you know, it's not – other things are going to matter more probably later on. And there's just very little way of knowing exactly what that is, either in that race, but especially in terms of what we're talking about. You know, this is a very complicated damn thing.
Yeah.
And in a very dynamic environment in which, you know, a lot of things that are relatively unforeseeable – any big way could intervene, affect the politics, and those are the and we have no way of knowing when that's going to grab the public's attention. And because of the media environment you're talking about, what the configuration of views of that event are going to be.
Yeah.
Right. Just not.
You know, one other thing I just want to. I think we're about closing out here. I mean, one other thought I was just thinking here about this whole thing and just sort of sitting here. I was like, you know. Thinking back over the last, you know, decade or two, have the Democrats really benefited from focusing on healthcare?
Yeah.
You know, and it's not to say it's not an important issue. It's not to say that, you know, we don't see like actual policy changes. We're talking about like right now, the uninsurance rate in Texas is down dramatically, obviously. And it's not because Texas expanded Medicaid. And part of the reason we have so many people, you know, using these subsidies is because we didn't. So like there are real consequences here. So I don't want to discount that. But when you think about, you know, the politics of healthcare and what we talk about, you know, there's this persistent share of people who say healthcare is the most important problem in the country, but it's never more than like 15%. That's like, it's usually about 10%, right? People raise issues about the system, you know, pretty consistently. But it's a very, you know, it's one of those things where I'd say it's almost too specific.
It's what I'm, you know, it's kind of, that's a different way of
being able to say it. It's not specific, but it's almost too specific.
What I was saying earlier, this idea, this thing, it's bubbling under, but it can't.
Yeah.
And part of it, I think, you know, and I don't, it's not a, you know, because I'm so skeptical of particularly on the Democratic side, people say, no, we don't have a policy problem. We have a communication problem, which is not true, generally speaking. I mean, or, you know, even focusing on those two things misses some bigger problems, but we'll set that aside. But I do think that, you know, if you look at healthcare and healthcare costs and healthcare insurance is one bucket of things or one little pool because of the metaphor of buckets won't carry over. And then you look at this other pool of shifting discourse around public health and vaccines and, you know, the role of government in promoting public health.
Yeah.
There's something there that seems to me to be maybe a little bit of a pointing towards some different way of talking about all this and, you know, solving the problem you're kind of alluding to with, you know, it's persistent but not predominant.
Well, you know, it's just, I mean.
I don't know exactly what to do with that as I'm sitting here thinking in real time, but there's something there. That's why I went with pools instead of buckets.
Let me throw something down in real time just to, you know, leave this on a thinking point maybe for people, you know. But I mean, it struck me in some of these articles, again, looking at some of the Republican arguments against the continuation of the tax credits. I mean, one of the big arguments that comes out is like, well, we shouldn't be subsidizing these healthcare companies. And I'm like, oh, well, that's interesting. You know, because this is sort of the system that was sort of fought tooth and nail to maintain.
Right.
To, you know, basically as a compromise.
It's what made Obamacare basically why Obamacare was really rooted in the Romney plan.
Right. It is. 100%. And so, and I mean, it came out of, you know, conservative think tanks. I mean, this was the way to institutionalize
the insurance. What was then conservative.
Yeah. Well, it was then conservative. But it is interesting to hear them say, like, well, we shouldn't be subsidizing these insurance companies and all that. And so one, I mean, just hearing this sort of like, you know, it tells you that there's something else going on there. And then the other piece to that that I'd also sort of throw into the pool is, you know, anytime that we have asked Texans in the last number of years about if they prefer, you know, the system that we have, this insurance-based system where you basically get, you know, most people get coverage through their employer and essentially, you know, but if they, you know, if they lose, but some people are just not going to be covered this way.
Yeah.
It just is what it is. Or if we had a universal government-based system where basically the government covers all the health insurance, but then, you know, you're going to pay taxes for it. surprisingly, and I really do mean this surprisingly, you know, more often, I mean, honestly, really, I think every time we've asked it, the plurality or majority of Texans have said, no, we would just take the government system.
Yeah, I think it's usually a plurality, right?
It's close. I mean, I think we've gotten a majority.
Maybe we got a 51.
But it's not like it's like a close cut because nobody really goes and says, man, this insurance-based system is great.
Yeah.
I mean, because, I mean, like, honestly, I don't think anybody says that. I just don't know anybody who does. I mean, if you do, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's somebody who does. You friends.
Well.
You some friends. But, you know, but for the most part, most people's perspective is that this is not, you know, the most, it might produce.
There's a lot, well, it's, you know,
there's
it's
a lot
basically
to
a way, it adds some dimension to this thing we're talking about. There's this underlying kind of dissatisfaction with it.
Right, absolutely.
And, you know, this is where, go to another thing we had conversation, this is where comparative.
Yeah.
We need to look at some comparative public opinion on this that would be interesting, I think.
Yeah.
All right. So with that, Josh, thanks for being here. Fun conversation on a busy week. Appreciate you making the time.
Love it.
Thanks, as always, to our excellent production team in the Liberal Arts Development Studio here at UT Austin. Again, we talked about a lot of data today. Have a look at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. You can always, you know, if you go to polling, we have a really pretty good search tool. If you hit healthcare and related issues in our search tool into some pre-selected key term menus or just do a raw word search, you'll find lots of stuff and it's very interesting,
tons
frankly. So thank you for listening. Check out that data. We'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.